This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first purchase. Hello, my sweet sons and daughters of the black dust of doom. It is I, D. Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and this is a very special pre-Thanksgiving, pre-Singularity episode. This episode takes place prior to that event at the end of time when human and machine intelligence will merge together, creating an event known as the Singularity. And right now, at this moment, as we approach that amazing event, like some water balloon rocketing towards a brick wall, we are also about to take part in the tradition known as Thanksgiving, where we will gather together around the table, surrounded by our blood relatives and friends, while we say prayers to God in front of a turkey carcass. Many of us are going home for the first time with our significant others, and it is very possible that you will be asked by your girlfriend or boyfriend's mima or papa to say a prayer at the dinner table. The pilgrims used to call this the judgment of the forsaken one, and if that gentleman caller stuttered even once, he would be dragged outside by a significant other's family and tied to the crow tree. His clothes would be ripped from his body. Crow paste would be rubbed all over his stomach, his nipples, and his neck, and flocks of crows would descend upon him and slowly eat him until all that was left was a bleached white skeleton, also known as a Thanksgiving clown. You don't want to be a Thanksgiving clown this year, which is why I have prepared for you a prayer that you can memorize and say around your family or your significant other family's dinner table in case you get called to say the family prayer. Here it is. Dear God, thank you so much for letting us exist. I can't believe we got even a few moments to experience what it's like to be thrust into time as monkey descendants with an advanced biocomputer that allows us to experience a past, present, and future. And though, at this moment, we may find ourselves surrounded by deeply brainwashed weirdos whose entire conceptualization of reality has been constructed for them by religious institutions, corporations, or politicians, please help us remember that our family is actually meat wrapped around the infinite goodness of the universe. And just because we are currently acting like vicious hyenas doesn't mean that we don't suffer just like anyone else. Help us see beyond our temporary mask of cuntiness to the never-ending transcendent glory that our puffy, wrinkled, alcoholic, racist, intolerant, hypocritical, news-obsessed skin suits hang upon. And thank you for this incredible show called Human Incarnation. Please grant everyone at this table a lifetime of ever-increasing, powerful orgasms. Orgasms that move all of us in the direction of heightened states of consciousness so that we can truly allow ourselves to surrender to the strange attractor at the end of time that is rapidly transforming history into something that will be completely unrecognizable to those who survive the economic and societal upheavals that await for us as we go plunging into the singularity. Thank you, God. Hare Krishna. Today's guest is one of my oldest friends. He's also the lead singer of one of my favorite bands, the Holy Sons, and I just saw him drumming for Om recently, and I felt as though I were witnessing some kind of ancient Hindu death god slicing off the heads of the saints. He's that good a drummer, and I'm not even exaggerating. We're going to jump right into this podcast with the amazing Emil Amos, but first, some quick business. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. If you go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan, you will get 10% off of your first purchase. How can you truly be thankful on this Thanksgiving when your website looks like something that was projectile vomited out of the mouth of a demon on the side of some cursed subterranean wall? It's time for you to get a new website, and the best way to do it is by going to Squarespace.com. It's easy to create a website. They've got a simple, intuitive process. You get a free custom domain if you sign up for a year. Squarespace was used to create my website, and I use their commerce tools for all of my t-shirts and posters and merch sales. They've got great customer support. It's 24/7. It's not by phone, but they do get back to you right away, no matter how trivial seeming your question may be. And if you want, you can try the service out without even putting in a credit card just to make sure that it works for you. But think of all the things you could do as the holidays approach. What a great, unique novelty gift to make a special website for your significant other's family. You could hire a private investigator to follow your significant other's father around and any strange pictures you might find. You could maybe post them on your website, and after the Thanksgiving meal, you could privately show your significant other's father these pictures and tell him that if he doesn't get off your back, you're going to publish this website and ruin his life. Squarespace.com. Check out DuncanTrussell.com if you want to see the power of Squarespace. Remember, Squarespace.com, offer code Duncan, and you will get 10% off of your first purchase. A deep thanks to those of you who continue to use the Amazon link located in the comments section of any episode at DuncanTrussell.com. Every single purchase you make through that link, Amazon will give us a very small percentage, and it costs you not a single thing. And Amazon has everything you need. Nipple creams, armpit hair removing gels, combs, toilet paper, paintbrushes, newspaper making materials, books on origami, the HTC Vive, gifts for the people over there at Standing Rock fighting the armor-clad Darth Vader-level mercenaries who are spraying them with ice-cold water in the middle of the night. Champagne, wrapping paper, things to drink, things to eat, teeth-dyeing materials, hair-shaving materials, razor-sharp knives, flare guns, compasses, binoculars, telescopes, Bibles, necronomicons, storage units for your bodily secretions that you can wrap in anonymous packages and send to your friends or enemies. It's all there at Amazon.com. All you got to do is click on the link located at DuncanTrussell.com. We also have a lot of beautiful t-shirts, posters, and a variety of cool things for you to give to your friends and family on the impending holiday season. Another way to support us that doesn't involve demon paper is to simply give us a nice rating on iTunes, subscribe to us, tweet about us, or join the forum over at DuncanTrussell.com. No matter what you do, I continue to be flattered and honored that you spend any time at all listening to this podcast, and I really hope you enjoy this episode. This is a beautiful conversation I had with the supremely talented Emil Amos. And if you really want to give yourself a treat, pick up a copy of the Holy Son's latest album, In the Garden. Holy shit. He knocked it out of the park with this one. He's an incredible drummer. He drums from the band Om, and he's a supremely brilliant human being who has a fantastic podcast on the same podcast network as I'm on, Feral Audio, called Drifter's Sympathy. I hope you'll give it a chance. It's lots of crazy stories, and I'm proud to say I pop up in a few of them. So now, everybody, please, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, the eternal outsider who's come to this universe from the edge of time, the magnificent Emil Amos.
Quick, listen back.
Here we are, everybody. We are back again on the DTFH with Emil Amos, who's in town playing with the band Om.
Tonight.
Tonight you're at, what's the name of the theater you're at?
The Regent Theater.
The Regent Theater, we went to get drumsticks. There's so many things about being a musician. It's a, you know, it's not what you would call an easy job. Like, you're constantly driving places, and when you're not driving, you have to be at the sound check at 5:30.
Yeah.
Which is vile, considering that you perform at 10. So you got to get there. How long do sound checks usually last?
I mean, it's not a fascinating subject, but...
It is fascinating because... I mean, not fascinating, but the idea is, for a person who isn't in a band or has never been around people in a band, the concept is a little more luxurious, I think, in people's minds than it actually is. Like, you don't realize the technical complexity that goes into getting everything together for a performance.
I think, if we're going to go down that road, what's interesting about it is that you may do all of it, meaning when you go to bed, wake up, what you do all day, where you travel so hard to get to, the sitting in the traffic and just barely inching in, and then you get to the end of that night, and this happened to me the other night. They handed me $42, and I went to the bar, and they wouldn't give me any alcohol, so I spent the $42.
Why wouldn't they give you alcohol?
I don't know. It wasn't in the contract.
Oh, they wouldn't. I thought you meant they wouldn't give you.
No, they wouldn't give me like drink tickets. So I spent $42. This was an isolated, I guess, obscure situation, but I mean, not that obscure. But like, so I spent the $42 that I made from that particular show to get a couple drinks, and I bought plane tickets. I rented a van. I did all the stuff. This is just one. This is what you would call a connection show, where it's not a major market, so you're just playing a show to get to the next major market. And it was poorly planned, and I was just stuck in a situation. And I laugh it off and have a drink and whatever. But in the grand scheme of things, when you rear back and you look at your life and the reward system that you're trying to wrench out and make sense of it for yourself so you can, pay for your rent and retire or whatever, it doesn't compute. So if you're looking at something that doesn't compute, to what degree are you sane to do it? And that's where I think the whole thing with art gets a little bit more interesting than just the daily grind, is that you're making an unintelligent decision. Didn't you say that? Or is that Louis C.K. said that, like, it's the dumbest profession in the world?
Well, I mean, that's the, like, that actually came into fashion for a little while. There was a series of various comedians. It was weird how just shit just becomes fashionable to say. So there's like a few people who are saying, like, don't follow your dreams. It's the worst idea. You'll be ripped to shreds if you have, who am I? I can't remember, some actor or something. I was like, don't look at me. I'm a privileged man who got lucky. Don't do this. And it really is a kind of like blasphemy, I think, to say those words, because your whole, that what it means is that you think you should only do things for some result, and that to do things for no result is to be insane.
Mm-hmm. But maybe that's what I inadvertently was saying, that it's like a healthy functioning form of a type of insanity, you know?
Well, I mean,
what isn't?
Right. That's where you get to with that. Yeah. Is like, yeah, because it's, you sort of have this never ending trumpeting coming from people about the responsible adult life, what it means, what it looks like. And the idea being that if you follow this, well, how does it go? It goes like this. I mean, everyone knows this, but here's the way you're supposed to play the game. To some degree, you go to high school. There's no choice there. Like, you have to go to high school. You can drop out at a certain age, but like, what's the worst thing you can do? Drop out of high school. He's a high school dropout. Is there anything worse to be? Like, it's like just a nightmare. So you go to high school, then college, then you study some skill set, and then you go get a job you barely like, and then in if you follow these protocols, somewhere in there, you will find some way to really enjoy your life in the midst of this thing that you do that really doesn't appeal to you too much. I don't know if you remember that ache. I can remember when I was sitting in, before I ever thought I'd be a comedian, when I was at college and sitting in one of these like insanely boring psych classes, And all of a sudden, the teacher just starts going into like here's realistically what you're going to do if you think you're going to make money doing this. You're going to, if you want to be a clinical psychologist, well, good luck there. But let's say you do become a clinical psychologist. You know you're just going to be sitting in an office with people all day long, just sitting and sitting, interacting with people. Maybe you'll, but you start realizing like, you know, when I'm reading these books about clinical psychology and I see how it's very fulfilling for the people who've written these books, but I don't think this is what I want to do at all. This doesn't seem remotely pleasant.
Yeah, I had the same moment. Maybe we're in class together, but I had the same moment where I was like, entered the field of psychology thinking, this is truly the most applicable form of philosophy, like this really exciting, open-ended ceiling thing. And then, yeah, it was around that time in class where I was like, I'm not going to do this as a profession.
This isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
I'd rather be dead.
But maybe more importantly, in the backdrop of all that is like, I feel like at that age specifically, and it never goes away, but it's like, it's sort of, there's a war on your own insignificance raging inside of you. Like, I can only speak for myself, but I know that other people feel this way, just haunted by their own insignificance, especially at that age.
Right.
Where you're like, that's what you're talking about in some form of just like, where am I going to, what am I going to do with my life? Where am I going to fit in? And where am I going to fit in the workforce? And how am I going to deceive all these people that, you know, don't know yet that I'm just a piece of shit? You know, or that you have a very low self-opinion at that point. And it's rooted in a certain truth. Like, you know, you'll never really matter. You look at the city skyline. I mean, at that age, you look at the city skyline, you're like, what does this have to do with me? I'm never going to like make a mark on this thing. I remember having those thoughts all the time. I still have them, but it was also a definitive moment of the India trip. Was I was standing on the roof of our hotel in Dharamsala with David. Yeah. And we were looking out at the sky. It was one of the great moments I had with David. And he looks out the sky. And in my mind, I'm thinking, Jesus, we're so lucky to be alive or something. And I turn to him and he says, I love India. And I said, no, I think you love life. Like, this isn't like a context of just this one thing you love, you know, or whatever. And he looked up at the sky and he's like, it's just so beautiful or something. But he looked sad. And I was like, why would you be sad about that? And he's like, it's just another reminder that I mean nothing.
Oh.
You know, he like personified looking out at this glorious thing, right? And he was like, instead of celebrating it, and I can really relate to that. I couldn't at that moment, but I really relate to him looking up at the sky sadly and saying, this is just another thing that I have really nothing to do with, he said. Mm. And I think that's something to remember about like a lot of phases of life is being haunted by insignificance. And you can spin it any way you want, or you can definitely turn it into a positive thing, or it does turn into a positive thing. In one way, I think you're really rooted in an essential truth of like just how small you are in some ways. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. But hopefully, as you grow, you see that in a perspective. You know, that gets put into a perspective. Like, maybe it doesn't matter what other people think of me. Maybe it doesn't, you know, you start to diffuse it.
What do you think's preferable? Being significant or being insignificant?
I think what's preferable is getting to a point where...
Wait, before you answer, I'm sorry. Can you define significant? Like, what is your definition of significant? What does that look like?
Well, I guess that's the problem, is that we kind of don't know what that means, and maybe until it's too late. It's one of the beauty... It's one of the nice things about aging is that you hope you gain perspective on this Catch 22.
But is Abraham Lincoln significant? Like, is it like a legendary figure, like Abraham Lincoln or like Gandhi or like Anne Frank, or are these significant beings, or is significance more related to your impact on your community?
I think it's an internal thing. I mean, if you're looking at Piaget or like how the ego is born and how it develops, I think in the beginning there are intrinsic levels of insecurity that happen as you're trying to put your feet down on the ground and be like, I'm me.
Yeah.
Right. And then whether or not this is interesting to anyone, it does seem to be true that as you get older, you eventually become more comfortable in your skin and you're like, I don't need as much affirmation from the outside. I know who I am. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then some of those hauntings tend to dissipate, you know? And, you know, I don't know if that's good or bad.
Do you think this is I hear you from, first of all, if somebody came up to me or wrote like imagine someone wrote a book and the title was I'm Significant. It would be such a fucking weird thing. It's weird to be like, hey, do you understand how significant I am? I'm very significant. You know that, right? I'm a significant man. I am a significant man. Oh, yes. Significance is a interesting problem to either to think you are significant is a problem, or to think that you are insignificant is a problem. It reminds me of, I had gotten this very brief, it was one of my favorite interactions with Buddhists, was at this Ram Dass retreat. We're leaving, and I stopped for a second. It's Roshi Joan Halifax, and I wish I could remember her friend, who was also a monk. And you know, when you see like real Buddhists interacting together, it's the coolest thing, because they are funny and playful. And in the moment, like, I saw the Dalai Lama, and he's got his translator who's always up there with him. And the translator kind of is, like, leaning off to the side. They're both smiling. He'll whisper something to the Dalai Lama. But it's like, you get the feeling like, oh, man, they're like surfers or something. It's the same feeling as, like, watching surfers, where you're like, wow, man, they've taken this, like, force of nature and are, like, doing these amazing tricks. Whereas these Buddhists, they've taken this insane reality and they're somehow surfing this nothingness in the most amazingly legendary way. So as I'm leaving this little like hotel room in Hawaii, I turn and I say to Joan Halifax, I'm like, you know, I sometimes I really think I feel more like you guys do, that maybe everything really is nothing. And then the guy she's with gets this big smile on his face and he goes, and it's also not nothing. And they both laughed. And it was so cool, man. It's nothing and not nothing. You know, so in the same way, it's you're significant and insignificant simultaneously. You're temporarily significant for your, you know, depending on which strata of perception you want to land on. I mean, for the infinite number of biomes living inside of you, you're certainly a significant thing because you're the medium that they're growing out of. You're significant for your impact that you have in the world. You're significant for just the fact that you are an alien living on a planet. I mean, that's wild and amazing, and there's something very significant about that. And yet simultaneously, you're completely, absolutely unremarkable, especially from the perspective of how many people are on the planet. You're an unremarkable, right now there's some person in some city, in some country, who's fucking amazing. Every word coming out of her mouth is like a butterfly made of language. Everything that he writes is the most amazing thing ever written. We'll never meet him. No one's going to know who she is, ever. An invisible thing from the grand perspective. Completely insignificant. And then, so, you know, the significance and insignificant thing is you're either doomed by one or the other. You just get to pick which one you decide you are.
Well,
and also, sorry, just to finish up that thought, how the fuck do you ever figure out who you are? Is that real? Like, are there people who are like, I know who I am?
I think that, you know, the definition of self-actualization is generally an internal significance, right? So there's a lot of different levels to this conversation, but you know, most significance that you can experience, you know, the significance of being alive is going to be an internal significance,
yeah.
Right? That's something that comes to you, hopefully. But, I mean, let's not forget that people are growing and developing throughout their life, and some people get halted for whatever reason or are designed differently. And so it's interesting that, I don't know if you saw that Leonard Cohen interview where he's doing the interview from the Zen monastery.
No.
I mean, I haven't gone through and like rechecked out his entire, you know, catalog since he died, but he's in the monastery and they're asking him, this woman reporter who's actually quite, she's pretty, her questions are really good. And she's asking something to the effect of maybe why he abandoned everything to go there. And his first answer is, you know, you don't get into this unless you're suffering.
Yeah.
You don't come out here and give up on everything and sit uncomfortably in a room all day,
right,
rigorously for months on end, unless you were brought there by suffering. Now that's his words.
Yeah.
But so her response is like, so you've dealt with depression? And he's like, oh yes, my right. entire life I've dealt with clinical depression. So here you have a nice picture of a human being. You have one of the great geniuses who is incredibly talented in ways most people may never refine. And then he has most of the things in life that anyone would ever want. And yet he's also, in addition, incurably depressed.
Right.
And so he's trying to find a balance and using Buddhism to try to, as a tool. So it's, you know, it's kind of a nice, it's a nice full picture of like, someone who has everything but is still struggling intensively with significance, insignificance, all these things, you know, and development and trying to get past their current stage of being halted. I mean, whether or not you think that's real.
No, it's definitely, well, no, it's that thing. Okay. That thing, like trying to get past your current stage. Mm-hmm. And so then you run into this whole, like, I mean, God, how many fucking things are there about how to change your life?
Mm-hmm.
There are so, everyone wants to change their life. Like, no matter what, that seems to be one. This change, someone, it's a compliment to say to someone, you changed my life.
It's like one of the oldest song lines. Yeah.
You changed my life. And it's a funny thing because it's like, okay, well, I mean, I do understand wanting to change your life. And yet every time you make the great change in your life, then within a few months, the change becomes irrelevant. And so you're back to, or a year, maybe, I don't know, a couple. So eventually though, you always get back to that state of like, well, time to change my life again. This time, what shall it be? I'll become a monk. And then you go and become a monk and you change your life. But then you go back to the world again or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what monks are doing. We really can't imagine what they're fucking doing. I mean, these are like in Dune, those things that were floating in the spice. Like they could be, who knows, when they're going into that state of meditation, they could be in some way or another interacting with forces we are completely unaware of that they don't feel like talking about. But when you hear like groups of people gathering together in those monasteries, that's like, I don't know what that is, and I'll never know what that is, but that seems to be something interstellar. Like they're like doing some kind of cosmic astral soul travel or something that we're just, you know what I mean? Like, so, okay. So I guess what I'm saying is the lay person has this, I'm going to change my life today. I'm going to only, starting today, it's the juice diet. And then I'm not going to lie anymore. Or whatever the thing is. So there's that. But then there's the real fucking thing, right? The real thing. And I think a lot of people who are seeking that change or the actualization or professing to want this change, if they really came to that opportunity mm-hmm. of absolute, like, oh, you do want it? Do you want to see the reptilians? Do you really want to see them? Mm-hmm. Do you really want to gaze into the black eyes of an alien? Is that really what you want? I'll show you, but it's going to drive you fucking crazy, and you're not going to be able to live in that normal world anymore. So really, if I show you, I'm hurting you. So I'm not going to show you because I love you. You know, that to me is like the difference between the pseudo change, pseudo actualization, mm-hmm. the seekers of change, the seekers of actualization, and the reality of the thing, which is mm-hmm. this theoretical vortex.
Yeah, I did my, I've been doing my own podcast, you know, and it's gotten to, I'm following the whole stage of development of being a confused teenager. And it's gotten to the point where you make the big change. It's like the last episode was the one about joining a cult or something.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, I don't talk to many people about it, but I know you must know what I'm talking about that moment, because you kind of went all the way and you changed. You, like, with even with the Hare Krishnas, I mean,
I had a religious experience.
Yeah, exactly. And so I find that moment, just as a basic hero's journey story, like, you know, it is kind of the crux of the whole story, whether you're Buddha or whoever, that moment where you decide to dedicate yourself to something that you've seen someone else doing.
Right.
And you're like, I'm going to abandon everything. I'm leaving my family. That's a fascinating, obviously dangerous moment. Like, that's why there's so many old after school movies about the little girl that takes acid and gets taken away by the cult, and the dad has to travel down into the cult and, like, yeah. wear a toupee and find her.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why they put the toupee in there, but it's just that they, it's like, it's such a classic story of someone getting taken off their, like, supposedly intrinsic path and put on this other path. And it's kind of one of the great, I would say it's one of the great moments of your life. Like, I hope you get inducted into a cult, you know, at some point.
No one understands this.
It's such a beautiful fucking thing, but then there's that day, you know, where you wake up years later with maybe clearer eyes or older eyes, and you look back at all the storm you went through, and you think of how naive you were at certain points, whether you what you believed in was real or whether it was an evangelist fantasy that someone created for you. I mean, that depends who you fall prey to or who you idolize and yeah. what path you take. I mean, I joined a cult that was, like, I thought was, I still would defend a lot of its tenets, essentially, but, like, that's a fascinating motherfucking point in your life right there.
How is it a cult, though? I mean, like, technically, it's like a cult of personality, some kind mm-hmm. of, like, mini cult of personality, not a, with a kind of, what are the tenets of this cult? Like, if you had to write down the tenets of this cult, what would they be?
I'm going to change the subject.
You can't say.
It's just that I don't know that particularly matters as much as the fact that, in a sense, when I...
You're talking about Boston.
Well, I'm talking about that. But in general, on the sidewalk, hit the pavement every single day, everyone surrounding you is in a cult at a certain level, a certain degree.
That's right.
Right? They're all kind of passing up the ladder of the philosophy of their cult.
Yes.
That seems like a pretty good model, actually, on how to sort of understand the war that's going on in the world right now. You know, because, of course, people are inducted. They're inducted into a frame of thought that has intrinsic worldviews, you know? And they've chosen that. They probably did not find these truths themselves, you know, to be self-evident. They've assimilated into, they put their energy into a shape, a form that they've seen somewhere, yeah. right? It sounded good enough or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
And so that it makes a lot of sense to me to anthropologically like look at the situation as though essentially everybody is in a lower level of a cult and they're trying to ascend into the and assimilate into the rules of that cult. And that's why everybody thinks they disagree. That's why we're all arguing with each other because we're all in different fucking stupid little cults, you know?
Yeah, and the but the problem is these cults are inevitably human-centered. So, like, and quite often there's some figure, this guy, that guy, who is the cult leader, right? And that's the big – cults are very specific. There's a strong – there's a central leader who has such a powerful energy that the surrounding people begin to imitate that person and like a daddy. Like, he becomes a daddy or she becomes a mommy. And just like you see a kid, God, and it's truly one of the most hilarious yet sad things to witness. When you see like the dad, the conservative dad, sitting at the restaurant, khaki shorts, hair combed a certain way. He thinks he's cool. He's like got his hair spiked up a little bit, definitely owns a jet ski, wearing a kind of shirt with a pop collar. And sitting in front of him at the booth are two little boys with their hairs cut exactly the same way. Their collars popped exactly the same way because his personality is so overwhelming that they have conformed to become little miniature
they're
versions.
They're within his orbit, yeah.
And they might be his name, too. Like, these are the people who name their kids their name.
Totally.
Which is just the most insane. I mean, that's really insane. The third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth. That, like, you're an echo or something. Like, your little boy is some repeating echo of your life that's going down through the ages. Like, you know, when you're a top... This is Dieter Schimpf the third. There's been two other Dieter Schimpfs who are so obsessed with their fucking selves and their names that they have had and their complete lack of creativity that they've named their kids themselves, but with a number after it. Really fucking weird. So
with the belief that maybe if they send their bloodstream out into time and space, they will win the war against oncoming insignificance.
Yeah, death. You know, like, oh yes, I'll live forever through Dieter Jeter 4. You know?
No, you won't. They'll live a few more years and that's it.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, this is the foolish, it's foolish, but there's your cult, you know? So like in the same way, you get some person, and it doesn't have to be an enlightened being. It certainly usually isn't. Usually it's like a successful person who has this rotten entourage surrounding them, like just little turds orbiting them. Like, it's a terrible thing to see. And then, like, when you witness the fact that the varieties of cults. Someone should write a book, The Varieties of Cults, and mm-hmm. break down the cults from the familial cult, the cult of daddy, the cult of mommy, the cult of my brother. You know, like, inevitably, you will run into a person who feels like they need to be the one fucking calling the shots in some way or another. So there's that. And then the next step up from that is the cult of fame or the cult of personality. So this is in high school. You know, there's some popular kid who's got a few other like less popular kids, but they're popular by association with this weirdo. So then you get that. And then that translates into modern world, you know, into adult life where you have the cult of fame. So there's some famous person who is allowing himself to be or herself to be orbited by another group of people who are also who share the power. I mean, God knows the power of the Kanye West entourage, you know, like a true friend of Kanye West wields the power of Kanye West. You know, I've heard stories like, you know, what's if you really want to find out about these fucking assholes, talk to the drivers. They dish on them so much. But anyway, so then you run into that. And then the next level up, right, is the religious cult. So now we have a person who's either been inducted into an organized religion and has been found to have some expertise or has gone through the phases of training to become a priest or whatever. And so this is like now it's getting organized. Mm-hmm. Now what formerly was an organic thing is being organized into a very specific training program. So it's like you are an initiate. If you go through the training, you will become a priest or a whatever, a cleric. And then you are allowed to take on your own followers. This is in the Hare Krishna system. They call them spiritual masters. So these guys have an orbit of devotees around them, disciples around them, who just want nothing more than to give them food or to drink from their glass when they're done drinking from the glass. And but now it's been, instead of it being like, hey, dude, you mind if I have one of your fries? Sure, I don't care. Danny, I love you, man. Oh, God, did you hear it? He said he loved me. No, I'm going to eat one of Frank's fries. Now it's become like, this is Prashad, the sacred leavings of a holy being on earth. And I, from eating this thing, will gather some of that energy into me. I will be somehow purified. And so then there's that level of it, right? So yeah, it's, and then of course, oh, and then don't forget the boss, right? That's a cult for sure as shit. The corporate boss. Oh God, corporate. Every time you watch those fucking Apple meetings, when they come out to announce their new product, it's like the same weird vibe you get from like watching the fucking Jonestown choir sing. And then the political cult, like the SNL thing where the what's her face did Hillary Clinton singing Hallelujah in that funny outfit, and you're just like, what the fuck is happening? So I get it. Yeah, man, every layer of society is a cult, but at what point is it real and at what point is it not real? At what point is there some significance to the pattern, and at one point does it become just like an embarrassment?
Yeah, it's very confusing. Eventually, you age out of the cult. You know, cults don't last forever, right?
Ram Dass calls them self-destructing traps. Like a good religion is a self-destructing trap, where once you get to a certain level, you're like, oh, I don't need that anymore. I don't know what I was thinking.
Right, right. You don't move on to a more valid way of thinking. Like you said earlier, you just move under a new paradigm that then has to shift again. But that's the nature of growth. But there's something really spooky implicit in the Westworld stuff. And it's not not in like a teenage high school, like, you know, you're stoned for the first time way. It's like the fact that these robots are working on loops. Yeah. Every single day she's going to drop that paint can or whatever.
Yeah. Condensed milk.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah.
And so the more you watch it, the more you have to ask yourself, well, everybody lives on a script.
Yeah.
You know, and it's part of just ritualistic functioning. And it seems a little dramatic to compare people to robots, but people do have robotic functions about them. I know I can feel them inside of me. And I think I cling to those things, believing that they are part of what keeps me happy or not depressed.
Yeah.
I like robotic functions. And so the more you get into worldviews and cults and, you know, different scripts and stories that we're all sort of following, each one of these cults has a story, like we were saying in the car, you know, that old saying about how there's only like seven stories you can tell, whether you're Shakespeare or Buddha or anything. There's like, you know, a certain amount of, it could be 8 Mile with Eminem, you know, like Karate Kid. There's just certain heroic tales that can be told that you're going to fall down one of these paths. And so within the world of those scripts, you know, you could choose one, but trace them back to their inception point. There's some sort of, everybody believes in their cult, there's some sort of legitimizing factor.
Yeah.
Like this, well, this, the Vedas are holy, and this is why. Like, why even try to legitimize it?
Yeah.
Why even try to say, this is official? No, this is the word of God.
They're 5,000 years old.
Who fucking cares? Like, you decide if it's real or not.
Yeah.
That's on you, you know? Like, why even try to validate it? But people will always try to make it sound like, well, this is the official truth. I was sitting at a dinner table.
That's funny. Official truth. Yeah,
exactly. Everything has to be verified with a little, like, blue check mark or something. I was sitting at this table, and a conservative older lady was going on this thing about how we came, that her family came to the country, and somebody threw out like, well, aren't we all essentially pilgrims infinitely? We're all just migrating. And she was like, no, our family, and she got heated. Our family came to America because we were religiously sanctioned to come. We were given money by the king. And we came here, and she went off, man. So in other words, she's drawn a line in the sand that everybody else in this country around her family or whatever is probably illegally here. We or here of some sort of, you know.
That's amazing. So she's like a man who convinced a bunch of idiots that he was a king, told my family that God wanted them to go to this place.
Yeah, they were sanctioned to arrive.
Because that is God. If you could go, just ask her the question, like, all right, well, who gave the king the power? Like, how did that? So you're saying, like,
I didn't even believe the story anyway. I didn't believe that some king told her family. That's a story. That's everything is a story that someone tells you, and someone else told somebody. It's a telephone game. It just goes on forever.
A king. There was a king who was like, hey, I want to speak with Roderick. I have decided to tell you to go to America.
Where I've never been and I have no interest in. But could you bring our religion? Here's $5.
We're sanctioned by the king.
That doesn't sound like an elating moment. That sounds like you're being banished and they've given you like a punishment clause of some money or something.
Yeah, the initiatory system's really funny. And this is probably why so many people are just so viciously and virulently against evolution, because it like allows, no matter what, you can always just be like, yeah, but you know, we all came from monkeys. Like it allows you to subvert in some way or another the puffed up quality of any person who feels like they've achieved some incredible state that has been sanctioned by a group or an organization. But all that being said, there is still, man, underneath the code, underneath the script that you're running, underneath the program that you're running, the never-ending series of tasks that you do robotically in your day, there is always this contact point with something that isn't human, if you really look deeply into it. Whatever you want to call it, I call it God. Some people call it universe or source. And that thing, that connection with that thing is real. That seems to be legitimate. That doesn't seem to be transitory. It doesn't seem to be.
Well, maybe that does seem like, not to be too Westworld nerdy about this, but like in my mind, music pushes forth past forms that are stagnant when God or the intelligence of human beings or the universe basically wants to advance. Like advancement to me is God or whatever.
Yeah.
The push past, the creative push past a stagnant form, you know, which is growth, which is evolution. And so maybe that's what they're trying to say on Westworld, the thing that's making them come, the robots come alive or something. Because what that is something that's breaking down the script, right? And yeah, it's ruining the script.
It ruins the script.
And God ruins the scripts.
Yes, and that's the best thing about it, is because it frees you from the script. It's this is this, and this is like the really like, God, one of the stories. Okay, so there's a Hare Krishna. I would actually, it's about as, God, just to go back again, to like just, go back against everything that apparently we've been saying. This guy, I think, if this guy is not a saint, I don't really know what a saint would look like. Like, this guy does seem like somebody that birds would land on or something. Like, his name's Radhanath Swami. He's amazing. Like, amazing. You just want to be around him. He doesn't want anything from you either, but you just want to be around him. Like, there's just this, when you get to be around him, you feel like some amazing good fortune.
So you're saying, like, within what appears to be a script, here's a person that's breaking away from scripts entirely.
Yeah.
Living in a free, wild zone or something.
Yeah, yeah. Wild zone. And, okay, like, I was hanging out with Zach Leary, is friends with him. He's like, come hang out with Radhanath Swami. And so we're just hanging out with this guy in this, like, very simple, I guess, apartment where the Hare Krishnas stay down in Culver City. And we're just sitting there, and he's like smiling, and we're talking, and then he starts telling these bhakti yoga stories, you know. And one of the stories he told is how Krishna is out in the forest playing with his friends. And it's like, I'm so hungry. We need food. And his friends are like, you know, because it's Krishna. This is like the symbol for God, the ultimate attractive force. So his friends are like, oh God, we have to get food for Krishna. What are we going to do? And so they like go to like their, they go, they find like near there, there's a temple where this priest, like an anointed priest, is like doing this long ritual with lots of food. And the little boys come up to the priest and they're like, hey, can we have some food? Our friend is hungry. The priest, completely unaware of the fact that these are like God's different parts who've come to him being like, hey, hi, actually, this is what we look like. Not like whatever the thing you thought you were doing in this long ritual, but this is what we really are. And the priest won't even talk to them, like won't even look at them, won't let them interrupt the ritual, right? And so then they go back to Krishna, like the priest won't give us food. And he's like, okay, go into the village and talk to this woman in the village and tell them that Krishna needs food here in the forest. And so they went and told her, and they're like, what? Ah, Krishna needs... The point is they drop everything. Once they tune into the thing, they drop everything to bring everything they have to this, like, reality, this new, like, eternal paradigm. But it's a really trippy story. But what it all boils down to, and these stories repeat in varying ways, is the moment you lay eyes on this beautiful being, your entire former existence is a robotic script. And at that moment of realization, or that moment of like actually witnessing the truth, which is that there is something way, way bigger than whatever you thought was the biggest thing, then all former patterns become completely pointless. And that's where you run into trouble. That's where you run into trouble. Because if you don't want to actually change, you just wanted to do pretend change, then good luck. Because now you've met a fucking alien, for lack of a better word. Something that's not embodied. Something that can be anything it wants to be. Something that is like fully aware of you. Deeply, deeply aware of you. Deeper than you're aware of yourself, and on top of that, loves you more than anything could possibly ever love you. That, like an ocean, like a billion oceans of love. Good luck. Good luck contacting that and then being like, oh, I'm just going to have a normal life now. No, you can't. You know, so you get to, you've seen the like video. There's a video that was on Reddit of this fucking scuba diver who's like, scuba diving, and he gets sucked into a wave comes over, and his friends are scuba diving. They look up, and suddenly he's just like, just sucked away, and they're like, "What? Like he's gone?" It's like that, you know. You in that can happen to you, and then that's not a cult anymore. That's something different. That's like more like being like. That's more like in Close Encounters of the Third Kind when the fucking UFO lands. Remember that?
Yeah.
And he decides to get on.
I see what you're saying. It's like the cult, and that's why I'm sorry.
I'm glad you see what I'm saying, because I'm.
It's just that maybe the word cult might turn somebody off, but it's a great model. It's a great way to see how everybody has chosen their training wheels. Right? They've shopped for their training wheels, and then they are probably, for quite a while, if not all the way until death, believing literally that these training wheels are the only thing keeping them going, right? So yeah. They've conformed to the mode and cut themselves in its shape and then never transcending it. And you're talking about getting down to the whole reason why you started down the path,
yeah,
which is transcending the training wheels, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, let's be honest, like a lot of people maybe never even perceive that there is that thing, that level. They're so stoked on the outfit they're wearing.
Right.
You know?
Which is fine. That's awesome. That's part of it too. I mean, but it's like, man, when you like start getting that sense of like, oh, wait, no, shit, wait. I really think there might be something out there, man. Like, It's like the wow blip, you know, that one of the most famous blips that like someone wrote wow next to it when they were scanning the skies for like aliens. And there was this like a blip that shouldn't be there. Like it was like a series of signals. I don't know the detail of it. I think they may have found out it was coming from like a microwave or something. But the signal was so like interesting that like they wrote wow next to it. Mm. But it's like we're all our own little mini SETIs, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. A lot of us don't realize that's what we are. We don't realize we're like radio telescopes that are seeking constantly for something. But if you just start experimenting with like, wait a minute, you know, it's like you don't realize like inside of your person, there's this dusty old control room, if you haven't gone in there before, covered in dust with all these weird like panels and lights. And you go in there and start like flipping switches. And then it's suddenly, before you know it, and the way you flip the switches may be from the Vedas, or it may be from Christianity, or it may be from some other methodology that no one even knows about. Who knows? But you suddenly get a wow signal where it's like, wait, that's not what I thought at all that it was going to be like. That's not what I thought God would be like. That's not what I thought at all. Because how could I think what it would be like? Because my incomprehensible insignificance, as we were saying in the beginning, cannot conceive of something like that. So you get a bloop, 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 bloop. Like, what the fuck? Wait, what the fuck? Oh my God, it's my best friend. It's my lover. It's my mom. It's my dad. It's my self. It's everything, but it's coming to me and it's saying, hi, you called? And then you're like, oh no, I didn't. Leave me alone. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that.
That's, yeah, I guess that would be the moment that, the moment that you realize that the world is an incredibly hospitable place.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It's actually like where you want to be.
Yes.
If you get to that moment, yeah, you know, which is what we all want. But that moment where you realize, you know, love is real, you know, the world is good, you know,
yeah,
which, you know, nobody really wants to talk about right now.
Right.
But it's just not the script right now.
Right.
But that moment is definitely going to render everything behind you that you just came from pretty meaningless. You know, you're not going to need all that stuff. And no, you're like, but I worked so hard to refine this appearance, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like it evaporates that for sure.
You find your friend. You find this thing. And it's like, and you forget about it again. But yeah, and then... You know, you have to start, like, there's a lot of things you have to start doing. You know, if you don't have to do anything at all, but to continue the romance, you have to, like, there, you know, it's just like any other romance. It's like you have to make steps in the direction and you can't be ashamed of it. And you don't keep it, you can keep it a secret if you want. It's very funny, though, because you won't be able to in the same way when you start seeing somebody in the beginning of, like, why don't we just, you know, keep this between us for now? But you're so happy and you're like driving around all day, like listening to love songs, and you're with your friend. You're like, you sure seem happy today. And you're like, yeah, well, I'm not going to tell you. No, tell me. Why are you so, oh, wait, you didn't hook up with blah, 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 did you? Oh, shit. Are you guys dating now? It's the exact same thing, but on a much bigger scale, because you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't tell people that I've been like figuring out or contacting or connecting or whatever, because if I start saying that, well
we populate our lives with these, like Westworld, we populate our lives with like villains.
Yeah.
Like the Wizard of Oz is a bad man, right?
That's right.
And there's all these fucking demon monkeys flying around and yeah, shit, and people are, you know, I mean, somebody's gotta die.
Yep.
So like the hero's gotta almost die.
Yep.
Or maybe he dies tragically, one of those seven stories. But, you know, that does seem really kind of laughable and sad that we spend all of our energy populating our world with this kind of like melancholy, like failure wish shit.
Yeah.
But only when it's seen within the light of this love experience you're talking about. Because then we return back to the daily temporal grind of like sort of enjoying the misery of the war, you know?
Yep.
That's what we're all doing right now. Everybody arguing with each other, you know?
Well, yeah, but then the problem is here's what it does. It's like, uh-oh, guess what? You just sweetened your tea and there's no way to unsweeten it. So it's like now what happens is when you're in the midst of whatever the fucking wonderful drama thing that you're in, as you're tweeting, you know, as you're, you know, tweeting some correction to something someone said about Trump, or you're like, you're letting someone have it over their fucking privilege, or you're letting someone else have it because you think the idea of privilege is insane or whatever it is you're doing. If you look at the, go down into the, follow the roots down and you find love. You find how much you're absolutely enjoying this fucking thing, whatever it may be. You're sucking the fucking fat out of the bones, man. You're like, oh, this is great. This, and that's the problem, because that's the concept here. This is, my friend just did a Skype. He did a kirtan, and like Ram Dass called in for Skype to talk to everybody. And this is right after Trump got elected, and they're all shitting bricks. And these are like, you know, they're up in, Ojai. These are like Ojai yogis, you know.
Where Krishnamurti lived or something.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. And so they're very troubled by Trump being elected. And so that's the first question for Ram Dass. What do you think about the election? His response, it's perfect. The election is perfect. And then, like, you know, he, like, moves out of the way, and behind him on his puja table is already a picture of Donald Trump.
No way. Yeah. That's fucking hilarious.
You know? And that is it. That's the subversion, man. That's where when you see these monks interacting and they have this smile on their face, and when you see, to me, that is, like, there's something so universally subversive about the romance that Ram Dass is having with Neem Karoli Baba, that the Buddhists are having with reality or nothingness or somethingness. That is so amazing, because, and I think for a lot of people, that's what they don't want. They don't want their tea sweetened. They want to feel bad for real. Like, no. This is really bad right here. This one, this is it. This is the bad, bad one. This one, there's nothing good. Listen, for all you people, I've seen this over and over again. For all you people saying there's something good about this, there's nothing good here. It's all bad, bad, bad. But then it's like, wait, the bad, bad, bad is good. The bad, bad, bad feels good. You're getting off on this, man, clearly. You're getting off on this. Your nipples have been made hard by the horror that you have invented or that you have perceived.
And, well, the drug of certainty, which is just loving that outfit and loving that shape of the cult, you know?
Yes.
It's a dangerous drug, man, because it's going to corrode you. If you go for that long thinking you're fucking right, nothing good can really come from that.
No way. Certainly no good tweets shall come from that. But then it's like, You this is the problem, because you realize, like, oh, right, this is, you're again thwarted by realizing that you're the architect of your own horror, and then you're just like, oh, right, because, you know, I want to be horrified right now. And you read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, you know, and it's like, even in the midst of that, he found a reason to live. He found, you know, there are people bringing, we've talked about, we always end up talking about this, but it's only because it's the ultimate example of a horrible situation.
Well, he sees the God energy and he goes towards that eternally. But, like, I think, to be fair, a lot of people just don't know how to transcend the unconscious cage of the script. I mean, I feel it too. It's just, very difficult to rise up above the architecture of your own horror story that you've written, you know?
Well, you can't.
Yeah, you've got to go straight through it.
You can't. Well, you can't. You need help. And that's where it's appalling to people. But, like, I had this crazy dream when I was visiting my dad in Alabama. Can't get it out of my head. And in this dream, I'm, like, walking in a field or some, you know, dreamscape. And I start praying, right? Like, please, God, you know, please. I think I was actually saying, like, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. And whenever I'd say that, above my head, these crazy symbols would form. Like, this, like, it looked like the, like, I don't know if you've seen, like, the top of a mosque. Like, it looked like these, like, sacred geometries would just go and, like, form these weird symbols. And, like, in the dream, I thought, oh, this must be what happens when you pray, is it's making some formation around you of energy or something like that. So the horror architect has spent all this time constructing a palace of pain that he's strapped himself in. And eventually you will get tired of that being so incredible. And if you're a skillful architect, then you have made, you probably like a maze within a maze within a maze within a maze. And down in the bottom of the maze is another maze. And inside that maze is a fucking manacle. And you've chained yourself to an iron pillar. And the key has been thrown in lava. You'll never escape. So you're hopeless.
It's a good story.
And down there is where you start crying out. You know, you start doing the, like, you start yelling, is there anybody here? Help me!
Yeah, I think you've realized that you've woven the shackles around yourself. You're starving. You're like, you need water, but you've betrayed yourself essentially to that point where you can't, you're dying, you know? And then maybe you can escape the story and the script and the maze and the minotaur and all that stuff. Maybe if you actually have to abandon it completely, maybe.
Yeah, and that's the key right there. Abandon it completely. That's where the problems come. Is where you like you want to go back, you know.
Right. Put me in my straitjacket.
Yeah, put me back in my straitjacket, please. I don't like this freedom. You don't like it. So you have to really give up. Like, you do have to, that, and that is the death that they talk about. Like, you do have to, like, you do just have to be like, you know what? I'm going to fucking give up this thing I was doing. You know, like, whatever it may be. So for, like, when I think back to, like, earlier versions of myself, being completely disrupted by some ambient noise in my environment, or, like, maybe getting on a plane and the person next to you, their arm is a little too far over. And you know what I mean? You're so fucking, like, unable to surrender to what, well, this is what's happening, that your entire plane ride goes into the most embarrassing war of, like, fidgeting to try to, like, push a person's arm over, or even worse, saying, can you move your arm? You know? So it's like,
well, the King of England, you know, gave me this armrest.
Yes, exactly. 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 Or you let go. And you don't let go all at once. It's little, like, I've learned to let go. Like, I have a fucking cat, two dogs, and a girlfriend. We all sleep in the same bed. And I've fought against that. And over time, they won. They all won. I didn't want dogs in the bed at first. I didn't want dogs and cats in the bed. But they won. And I love that they won. And now is like, as I'm laying in bed and a cat clambers over my chest, what formerly would make me fucking mad has now just, like, nothing. Like, yeah, a cat walks over my chest sometimes. And then I go back to sleep. So I think that's what, on a micro, that's what you start doing with every fucking thing. Every single thing. You just let go. Okay, this is happening. This is happening. This is happening. Okay, I let go. I let go. I let go. And then on top of that, you start saying, thank you. Thank you. And then maybe that breaks you out of the dungeon or something. maybe that breaks you out of your prison of pain. And maybe, just maybe, you realize you weren't the smartest thing. That, to me, is the ultimate hope. You're not the smartest. Humans aren't the smartest thing. You're not the smartest thing.
Yeah, and then the moment for me was kind of being like, and how could this story have really been any different? You know, this was meant to be this way.
Yeah.
That was one of my most liberating moments, was looking at the world and being like, it's supposed to be like this.
Yes.
You know, it's hard to get back to that spot, but...
Oh, God, but what a great spot.
I never felt better than that.
It's the best. Like, that place is so... Even if you're like... You're like... I mean, this is the kind of glory of the experiment, is that if you do theoretically make contact with this thing, God, universal truth, whatever, your own deeper transcendent self, God is just such a term of convenience. But like, then what you can do is start running these experiments. You start running experiments. So it's like desperately hungover. Your head feels like a rotting tooth. And there you're like, is it here? Is it here too? Oh, fuck. It's here, too. Even with this monster headache. Even with this sickness inside of me. Where is it not? And you can't find that place. And so we end on a pregnant pause. Emil, thank you for doing this podcast, man. Can't wait to move to New York to be around you.
Have you said that on the podcast?
Yeah.
Shit. Well, we'll see. This is another new paradigm of growth.
And my life will change. And may everyone's life change. Thanks, Emil. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everybody. And a big thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode. Remember, go to squarespace.com. Use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first order. And don't forget to subscribe to us. Give us a nice rating on iTunes if you like the episode. Go through our Amazon link, sign up for the form, and have a fantastic Thanksgiving. And now here is the title track from the Holy Sun's new album, In the Garden. It's called In the Garden. I guess that's what a title track means. Hare Krishna.
Every single stone in paradise alone bides his time in innocent ways, along with the birds playing games of words. Resting in the dark, break into a thousand shadows. saw this early care. We curse the words these ladies.